And the title of it was Anti-Americanism is Resurging in the Arab World. And it went on at some length, describing in detail many of the anti-American actions it had seen in Syria and Lebanon. The document could have been written yesterday, changed the date and the names. It was exactly the same. And one part of it, though, which I really kind of, you know, focused in on, it gave a list of the reasons why the Middle East was becoming anti-American. And one of them was, and this is a Department of State quote, one of the reasons was a sincere objection to America's part in Palestine developments. So by 1950, the United States is well aware of what its involvement in the region is doing. And so the blueprint is already in place for this expanded role. And then you see, you know, in rapid fire, you see events like Suez in 1956. In 1953, you saw the overthrow of Mossadegh, and then you have the overthrow of revolution led by Karim Qasim. 1958, there's an intervention in Lebanon to try to actually, at that point, prop up Kamil Kamoun, and so on. So the United States is increasingly involved. And within those areas, you start to see the development of indigenous resistance in 1960. Inside southern Vietnam, the anti-American, let's call them that for a moment, forces established the National Liberation Front for South Vietnam. And then in 1964, the PLO was established. Something interesting, too, is the idea of, for want of a better term, geographical legitimacy. The United States will always say that, and Ken Burns and liberals say this today still, that North Vietnam invaded South Vietnam. The resistance really was in the South. The North clearly had, was run by the Communist Party of Vietnam. Most of the Southern resistance were people who were Southerners. You know, the U.S. would say they were outsiders and they were, you know, trained in the North to go into the South and so forth. The vast majority, almost the entire resistance in Southern Vietnam was Southern. These are people who had fought with the Viet Minh, they fought against the French, and they remained there for the most part. The resistance in southern Vietnam was indigenous, right? And we hear this all the time, this trope of outsiders coming in and creating problems. With regard to the PLO in Palestine, we know that it's an indigenous movement based on these really long-standing developments. But the same thing happens in Vietnam, too. You would continue to hear this, you know, they invaded us kind of stuff. But the reality is, first, there really weren't two Vietnams. One was just artificially invented. And the reality was that the Vietnamese fighting in the South, trying to get rid of the government, were actually Southerners themselves. And, you know, when I started to understand politics later than the 60s, but not much, two of the people who were often lauded and linked together were Ho Chi Minh and Yasser Arafat, you know, as well as Castro and Che and Nelson Mandela and others. But Ho and Arafat were always lauded on the left as part of the same struggle. And, you know, you don't have to be a communist to understand the importance of those third world revolutions. They gave each other support, but it was also important to have countries like the Soviet Union and China with regard to these smaller places because they had what they saw as some protection. They had a little bit of cover, which I think is one of the biggest differences today because Palestine's isolated in ways that Vietnam never was. Vietnam fought on its own. It had an amazing military, but it also got significant levels of support and aid from countries like the Soviet Union and China, whereas obviously today in Gaza, there's nothing like that, and the other Arab states are not involved in ways really at all, right? But those liberation movements in the 60s were really crucial. Okay, the United States, you know, it always has this rhetoric, we were born of revolution, all that kind of stuff. The United States despised these revolutionary movements. Inside Vietnam, the United States began fighting a massive war. Vietnam is obviously much bigger than Gaza, but neither of these are big, massive, huge countries, right? Inside Vietnam, the United States began to employ massive firepower. Inside the military, there was actually a great deal of resistance to the Vietnam War because, you know, these generals and admirals said, we're preparing to fight against the Soviet Union in Europe. I mean, the idea of using B-52s, which are these massive bombers, they can saturate an area with one flight, one sortie of 1 by 2 square miles. The idea of using B-52s in Vietnam was considered crazy by Air Force generals, yet they did it. The United States established free fire zones, search and destroy missions, They deforested entire areas with herbicides, napalm, Agent Orange, white phosphorus was used broadly. If you were to put together a list of the kinds of things the United States did, it would match with great, you know, synchronicity what's happening today with Israel. The United States in Vietnam, especially in the later years of the war after Nixon took over in 1969, began to attack the North more vigorously, which included bombing schools, civilian centers, hospitals, and so forth. Very similar to today. The biggest difference, though, is the DRV, and as I mentioned before, had the capacity to fight back much more strongly. It had received a great deal of military equipment from the Chinese and the Soviet Union, especially. It had surface-to-air missiles, which it used with great effect. In the famous Christmas bombings of 1972, Nixon claimed that the United States bombed Vietnam so badly they came back and negotiated, right? The reality is actually quite different. The Vietnamese in the Christmas bombings shot down an estimated 34 B-52s. And in my, I forgot to look up, I forgot what they cost each, but it was, the United States took significant losses in Vietnam. One thing I'd be curious, this is what Israel's lost in Palestine, in Gaza today, right? Because we do see those videos, we saw those quite a bit, where Israeli tanks are being blown up and sabotaged. And remember, in both of these places, you have similar wars, you have these kind of guerrilla wars going on too, these partisans. So I think that's kind of important to understand too. So the United States is just destroying Vietnam, right? A small country, which, you know, the world was really aghast at that, but didn't really do much about it. Again, very similar, right? The United States would establish what they call free fire zones, where everybody in the area was considered Viet Cong. The war in large measure was based on, the success was based on body counts. How many of the enemy did you kill? And the old saying was, if it's dead and it's Vietnamese, it's a VC. Older people, kids, buffalo, right? So the United States is racking up these huge body counts because it's just destroying everything in sight. The United States displaced villagers. It created a strategic hamlet program in the early 60s where they took people away from the villages where they'd been living. Peoples who had lived there, their ancestral homes, their ancestral graveyards, and so forth, they removed them and put them into these strategic hamlets, which were referred to at the time as concentration camps. So there is a forced dispossession of people in Vietnam, too. So, and the one thing to keep in mind is it's what I'm seeing today is horrific. It's chilling. I haven't seen anything like this really since the Vietnam era. But it's not unique. This is the way empires, and clearly the way the United States does things, right? It included massacres, right? We've probably all heard of My Lai. My Lai occurred pretty regularly, and more stuff has come out about that now. There was a force called Tiger Battalion that would go around in its area of operations and just kill entire villages. My Lai is the best known. In My Lai, I think 400 people were killed in that particular day, and we're probably familiar with it, where American soldiers just went in, literally, you know, filled ditches up and killed people and raped women. It was horrific, right? In that same region, in March of 1969, the United States killed 10,000 Vietnamese with airplanes, with air power. So we focus on the atrocities, but, you know, what you see is this entire attack based on these, you know, real violations of war. There were people who were accusing the UN of violations of international law, of war crimes, of atrocities. There were citizens' tribunals led by the famed philosopher Bertrand Russell. American soldiers in a group called the Vietnam Veterans Against the War had winter soldier hearings where they went around the country letting people know what they had witnessed or what they had done in Vietnam. And then you see this, of course, in Israel as well. The United States got closer to Israel after 1967. American aid to Israel was clearly significant from the start, but fairly temperate, relatively. So from the creation of Israel until 1959, like the first decade of its existence, the U.S. sent $650 million to Israel, and only a small percentage of that was considered military aid. In the 1960s, that increased to $834 million, and about 30% was military aid. But by the 1970s, you see this massive growth in it, up to over $16 billion, and over 70% of that is considered military aid, and then it obviously grows from there. So the United States is also making this massive economic, financial commitment to both Israel and Vietnam to try to defeat both the Viet Minh, Viet Cong, National Liberation Front, and the forces of liberation inside Palestine, right? One thing I always point out here, because I think it's important, is that Jimmy Carter had a big role in this too. Carter, you know, did amazing things after he left the White House. I think very admirable. As president, Carter was a friend, a real good friend to Israel, American aid. There are two major spikes in that era. You have aid, which goes up, but in 1973, there's a huge spike, right, because of the Ramadan-Yom Kippur War. And then in 1979, there's another huge spike because of the Iranian Revolution and the oil embargo. Carter is responsible for that. Carter quadrupled military aid to Israel in 1979. He also fired his representative to the United Nations, Andrew Young, because Young had met against orders with Yasser Arafat and other PLO representatives at the United Nations. So this is also, importantly, a bipartisan movement, right? And I have all kinds of data on American support of Israel. I'm sure you're familiar with it already. I just discovered this recently, so I thought it would be interesting to mention it because I myself had never even thought to look into this. But there was an intersection. There were some intersections between Vietnam and Israel itself. In 1963, Israel floated the idea of recognizing South Vietnam. South Vietnam, the U.S. had recognized South Vietnam in 1955. Israel suggested to the U.S. as a show of support that it would recognize South Vietnam, the Republic of Vietnam at the U.N. And the United States said no, because, and this is an important issue at the time, the U.S. was afraid that if Israel was linked to South Vietnam, it would alienate liberal Jewish voters in the United States. And that became really an important issue throughout the duration of the war. This idea that most American Jews were very liberal and many already were starting to question Vietnam. And they obviously weren't going to question Israel. But if Israel were linked to this U.S. war in Vietnam, then that would be problematic. On the other side, the North Vietnamese did recognize the PLO in 1968. So there's already a link. But the one in with Israel and South Vietnam I found really quite interesting. Israel did play a role in the Vietnam War. Not a big one, but it did provide some fairly limited military advisors and training. And a lot of this is symbolic. It's a way of saying to the U.S., you know, we're with you. And it was, I think to some degree, it's a way of saying thank you for what you've given us. But military advisors and training were important, especially in areas of counterinsurgency and special operations, which became a huge industry. And it still is, right? In the 80s, Israel was very active in these areas in Central America where the United States was trying to overthrow or stop these liberation movements like Guatemala and, you know, Salvador and Nicaragua. So Israel had a huge role. They would often set up the internal security apparatuses in these places. Israel provided some munitions and equipment, shared some intelligence, gave them some legitimacy with diplomatic relations. The U.S. rejected Israel recognition of South Vietnam in 1963. However, a couple of years later, in 1965, the United States significantly increased its role in Vietnam's massive escalation of the war. The war wasn't going well at all. It was never going well. And so in 1965, the United States actually reached out to Levi Eshkol, the prime minister, and asked if Israel could take a bigger role in Vietnam. You know, they wanted more assistance. This time it was Israel, which was reluctant. By 1965, Israel believed it had gained more international credibility and legitimacy and didn't need that association with the U.S. the way it had before. Johnson, Lyndon Johnson, the president, wrote to Levi Eshkol that if Israel supported Saigon, it would give a clear signal to the world of Israel's support for resistance to aggression in Vietnam. But the Israelis at the time didn't do it. They didn't think it was in their best interest. Israel began meeting with Vietnamese officials to discuss what kind of support they might give or what they might need. They did seek, South Vietnam began to seek Israeli recognition in 1965. But this time, in a flip, Levi Eshkol said that he couldn't do it because if Israel was going to recognize South Vietnam, the Republic of Vietnam, then would also have to recognize North Vietnam, which really pissed the United States off. Dean Rusk and others were very angry, essentially, like, after all we've done for you and you can't even do this. The other piece where I saw an intersection occurred in 1969, after Golda Meir became prime minister. In 1969, Richard Nixon gave his famous silent majority speech. He said, yeah, there's people out in the streets opposing the war, but most Americans don't. The silent majority supports us. Golda Meir sent him a note congratulating him, saying, what a great act of courage. Blah, blah, blah. The note was leaked. And inside Israel, it caused a firestorm. There was a kind of a pro-American paper named Mariv, and they attacked Meir for supporting Nixon. So clearly, public opinion in both Israel and among liberal Jews in the United States was anti-Vietnam War. Inside Israel, after Meir's message to Nixon was leaked, a rabbi named Balfour Brickner, gotta love it, you know, your kid Balfour, so it says a lot, right? You know where what he's going to do, right? But he was a director of interfaith activities for Reform Judaism, said, Golda Meir has driven a wedge between herself and the liberal intellectual Jews of America, who saw no conflict in supporting Israel's struggle while opposing the unjust, unwise war in Vietnam. He said that Meir reaching out to Nixon would alienate many of Israel's friends and America's academic community. How quaint, they cared about what professors thought back then, because no one's asking me my opinion on anything right now, right? It would alienate liberal Protestants and Catholics and the clergy and among politically active young people with liberal inclination. Both of these countries, then, both of these situations are part of this global anti-colonial movement for national liberation, and they're getting the same response, and that's important. It's just going on all over the place. It's also interesting because one of my side gigs, I call it, is I am often at war with Oliver Stone's people over the Kennedy assassination. The assassination itself, I don't care about, but their basic argument is that Kennedy was a man of peace and he was going to change the world and he was going to get out of the Vietnam War. One of the things they cite is that Kennedy stood up to Israel. I'm still not seeing that. And I actually look at all the documents. I don't like look at vignettes like they do. The United States took basically the same approach to events in Palestine. The PLO was immediately labeled a terrorist organization. Aid increased to governments in that region. As I said, as part of this regional arrangement as well, right? And in both places, you also saw regional wars. Who knows what Gaza will look like going forward, right? But it's really a terrifying thought. Vietnam, again, though, as I point out, was fortunate in that it could get outside support from places like, the Soviet Union and China. The axis of resistance, the so-called active resistance, is very different, right? It does have a level of involvement, you know, in supporting the fights, but nowhere near what countries like, the Soviet Union or China would, right? The United States could go after Laos and Cambodia, but it's not going to go after the Soviet Union and China. And in fact, Nixon creates a detente specifically with the Soviet Union and China. The United States understood Vietnam was a bad idea and began to look for outlets after Nixon took over, especially Kissinger in 1970, said this is going to be the year of Europe and we're going to reach out to the Europeans because Vietnam is a bad idea. There's nothing similar to that now, right, where everybody just doubles down on what is already clearly a genocide, right? Another part that's important, but again, plays out differently, is global condemnation. By the later 1960s, the U.S. was really getting an earful from its allies. And I've seen documents on that from the British, from the French and others saying, you're destroying the alliance. You are giving the Soviet Union massive propaganda victories. You're destroying the global economy, which is a real issue with these wars, right? So they're encouraging the United States to get out of Vietnam or to delay it or to de-escalate or whatever. Eventually, the U.S. does. I respect the hell out of the anti-war movement. I would argue the United States finally de-escalates in Vietnam because the global economy requires it. And I've often wondered like how that will play out today because we're obviously in a time of real precarious economic conditions. So far today, those major allies continue to support the United States, places like the UK and Germany. Now, lately, we've seen what I would still call more or less performative changes in that. And I don't know how those are going to play out. but they tend to be, you know, kind of smaller. You see these statements coming out of places like the UK or Italy or Spain. And that, I think, eventually is really going to be crucial. By itself, it's very difficult to defeat the empire, especially an empire like the United States directly in Vietnam, where it's just, you know, the United States dropped 4.6 million tons in a place the size of New Mexico. The United States is subsidizing it, but it has the same effect today. Another thing that I think is important is that we've seen an abandonment of what used to be called soft power. Not that I'm a proponent of soft power, but they don't even try that anymore. They immediately go straight to the most violent responses possible. This is also true of resistance at home. The anti-war movement is now met with violent and immediate resistance. There's no assumption. I mean, Trump does not differentiate between like nonviolent or violent protest or whatever, right? They're all to be met the same way. Right. And we obviously saw that. I know you had an event with the directors of the encampments. One thing that struck me, like just to take Colombia for an example, in 1968, when SDS occupied Hamilton Hall because of the Vietnam War, they actually went into the building and took over several offices. They took over the dean's office, the provost's office. It took a week for the Colombia administration to bring in the police and the removal. You know, they roughed them up and stuff. But now it's immediate. You know, it's immediate and it's rough. The other part, though, that I think is somewhat hopeful is it did take a long time in Vietnam. You know, Noam Chomsky and others have said the first actions they ever saw didn't occur until like around 1965 when the war was well underway. Now it's immediate. It's immediate, right? On campuses and communities and elsewhere. So that may be some cause for hope. Let me kind of just, you know, to sum up, I think Gaza is an example of the lessons of Vietnam, but I think a lot of it is that the ruling class has learned those lessons too, and they're doing things differently. They're doing things immediate. They're hitting with a level of force that they hadn't used before. The ideas are the same. The goal is the same, to defeat liberation movements. These movements could be called communists. They could be called terrorists. In Vietnam, the rationale for opposing them was, or opposing anti-war people, was that they were communists or they were communist dupes. Today, calling somebody Hamas fills the same role, right? In 1969, you know, Ho Chi Minh is the new Hitler. They're a bunch of terrorists. Today, it's Hamas, right? It's an old playbook, and they've learned well from it. So I think understanding, I'm not sure how much it helps nowadays, because let's face it, it's a fairly bleak situation. But I think understanding America's long time resistance to movements like this and the lengths to which it will go to defeat these movements, often very violent means, right, is worth knowing. But within that, I do think that there are ways that these people who I really admire the hell out of, right, these groups who are out there. It's interesting not to single out JVP, who I think does great stuff. I don't want to like shortchange Palestinians resisting as well. But JVP often reminds me of a very important group in the Vietnam era, VVAW, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, because veterans had a particular kind of credibility and legitimacy. They were in the war. And I think JVP kind of has that too, which is why you see the media pay so much attention to them. It makes it a little bit harder, I think. You know, it wasn't that easy in the 60s to say, oh, those guys are a bunch of communists. They're veterans. They were fighting in Vietnam. And in the same way, it's a little harder, I guess, to say that JVP is anti-Semitic. I want to end with a poem by Ho Chi Minh. Ho Chi Minh was a great poet. And I always like this one because it kind of shows the sense of kind of hope that he had. He wrote this when he was under arrest. But as he was in prison, he wrote, "Being chained is a luxury to compete for. The chained have somewhere to sleep. The unchained haven't. The state treats me to its rice. I lodge in its palaces. Its guards take turns escorting me. Really, the honor is too great." Ho wrote that at a very bleak and dark moment in Vietnamese history. He was imprisoned. The Viet Minh were fighting against the French and the Japanese, and then eventually the French again and the Americans. And yet he saw this kind of hope, this sense of light, and it's very hard to find nowadays, right? So I think it's better to end on this note that even in the midst of the Vietnamese Revolution, Ho was in jail. Van Nguyen Giáp was in jail. French authorities killed General Giáp's wife. There were massive large-scale killings Viet Minh and Viet Minh supporters, or people who even just like were accused of being Viet Minh, right? Ho still had that idea that he could be whimsical and talk about it and talk about what he called a Vietnam 10 times more beautiful. And I think people today who see, you know, a free Palestine in the future are doing the same thing. And I think that's really critical. So thank you again, and all of you. And I really appreciate this.
You were just listening to Robert Bezanko on Vietnam Then, Palestine Now. He spoke in Washington, D.C. in mid-June 2025. Robert Bezanko is an award-winning scholar and a professor emeritus in history at the University of Houston. He's co-host of the Green and Red podcast. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Chris Hedges, Naomi Klein, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Robert Bezanko on Vietnam Then, Palestine Now, and for Rashid Khalidi's classic book, The 100 Years War on Palestine, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Fairuz singing in Arabic, Sanarji'u Yoman, one day we will return.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent.
This is Bird Note. Northern mockingbirds, the continent's most proficient copycats, can learn to mimic the sounds of just about any other bird within earshot. But they mimic to show off, not to deceive. Males with the greatest repertoire are the first to attract mates. That's the payoff. If a mockingbird imitates a cardinal song, it's unlikely any cardinals are fooled in the process. No harm, no foul, no deceit intended. But a tiny songbird in South America called the thick-billed euphonia does employ what scientists call deceitful mimicry, a very rare trait among birds. When frightened by a predator near its nest, a thick-billed euphonia imitates the alarm calls of other birds nesting nearby. This stirs them into action, and they rush in to harass the predator, maybe chasing it off while leaving their own nests in peril. The euphonia, meanwhile, sits tight, maybe shouting out a few more bogus alarms while others do the dirty work. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.